wages. Look at these wages, they pay us as pennies and pains as they paint us in corners on corners. What can we do, man? We're cornered. I'm lucky I'm stuck in this booth, stuck here all cooped up. People get stuck up for loot, stuck up in
booth. CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hey, good evening, and welcome to this week's edition of Dromatext, another COVID-19 edition, set recorded at home. We're going to be listening to the poems of Wanda Coleman tonight, a few by Eileen Miles, and we'll finish up the show with something by Deanne De Prima. Wanda Coleman, the late Wanda Coleman, hailed from Los Angeles, an extraordinary poet, and we'll be listening to some of her readings and interview that she did from the radio station in Southern California. Here she is, Wanda Coleman.
Ethelbert Miller, who's a mutual friend, says that American poets are all children of Walt Whitman, and you would consider yourself in that lineage.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us why.
Well, I think because I'm a part of the chorus that's singing America. You know, that song of ourselves. Whitman's, I'm a child of Whitman in a pragmatic sense, that poetry, poets are not businessmen, but we're forced often in a position to represent ourselves in that arena, to dicker for the check, to find ways of, new ways of patronage to support what we do, filling out grantsmanship applications after application, sitting on panels, entering the university system, teaching, doing all of these things that are sometimes antithetical to who we really are. Because unlike, to me, this nation is upside down in terms of how it treats its artists in the fine arts across the board, the visual artists, those in the world of dance, those in the world of theater. And the ascension of Hollywood has eclipsed our truly wonderful artists. I mean, it's to me, it's a tragedy that the jazz has left the club, the venues where it was born, and is now to be found in the museums, an artifact. And I think that's a tragedy. And that because music has been devalued in our school systems across the nation, we don't have those ears that are so necessary to perpetuate the love and appreciation of that excellent, that incredible musicianship. Well, that's true of poetry as well. Poetry is still looked at as something that's not necessary, that's a luxury, that's not a vital part of life. And yet there are so many, you know, it's so easy to, you know, to meet someone who will shyly open a drawer and pull out a manuscript and show you that they write poetry. But poets are of no monetary value and therefore are of no value at all.
What is the value that poetry and art bring to a society?
It makes, it's man's highest dialogue with himself. It enriches, it deepens life. That's something it shares with religious belief. It gives you a reason to go on. For the sake of the cool, the magician stumbles in after a long jam, peeling notes off the walls. He washes his dry, so long ago hands, settles in for a sleep till 2 afternoon. Just another escapade in rayon, prelude to a shower and the joys of happy hour. To mute or not mute, hush now, such tough, satisfying labor to make 'em sing. Shades of bliss, molten notes, star hot, stalking inspired ears, make 'em sing. tongue, violent in the blood, that soul stomp of leather to the wood, hand meeting hand, to make 'em sing for the sake of the cool, to be obvious must be forcedly understated, and what has snapped held together by strong clams until a needle and thread can be applied for the sake of the cool. Stupid risks must be taken, but risks nevertheless. Things uttered and dismissed and reconsidered and mitigated until terms are defined and mutually understood for the sake of the cool. No one's hero goes to jail for trifling things. And indirectly, jazz allows men to worship men without onus. Spirit, dig, coon, holla, hallelujah, riffs all rush and muddy. But the women must fend for themselves and make 'em sing for the sake of. Days of Our Lives, as the hands drip through the hourglass. Yes, I wrote for Days. That was a real adventure. It was very exciting, for the year or so that it lasted, and I was the youngest member of the staff, and I had it was quite an experience, because writing for television is merciless when it comes to deadline. It knows no mercy. It eats writers. It eats everything you have to give. And so it was difficult in one way, because my portrait was subsumed. I mean, it was just gone. And I frankly was worried about that, and depressed about it, because I didn't know, what's going on here. But what I found is that after, my style of writing, before working for the soap opera, I was still writing on the legal tablets and the secretarial pads and writing things out in longhand and, taking, 10, 15 drafts and still not getting it right. But after that stint as a soap opera writer, I could crank. The poems, when the poetry came back, when it returned, I mean, it just returned with a vengeance. And I found that I could sit down and those poems would just start coming. They would just flow. It was almost as though they were writing me instead of me writing them. And so that was, and I said, wow, look at this. So when my peers look at my books, when I go to poetry book fairs, and there are these very fine, thin, lovely books of poetry, and then my volumes are considerably, 300 pages, fat books of poetry. And people say, how do you do this? Why are you so prolific? Well, that's a part of it. That experience freed me from whatever there was in my psyche that made me hesitate or take so long to finish the work. I was able to, at that point, see, I had just become a better worker, a better craftswoman. And it would, if it were collected, so I'll have to just select it, be selective, and have a slimmer volume.
All right. Well, talking about your poetry is one thing, but hearing it is quite another. So do you have something you'd like to read for us?
Sure. Why don't I start with one of the sonnets? I had an idea for 100 sonnets, and every now and then, sometimes you want to play with the traditional, and you want to maybe do something new with a traditional. So the idea came to me of jazz sonnets. And I couldn't tell you what a jazz sonnet was at the time I had the idea. And I applied for some grants, the NEA and whatnot, which I did not receive, to do these sonnets. And then I just abandoned the idea. 10 years later, the first one showed up. And I recognize that, and I call them American Sonnets, and this is number 12, after Robert Duncan. My earliest dreams linger, wronged spirits who will not rest. Dusky crows astride the sweetbriar, seek to fly the orchard sky. Is this the world I loved? Groves of perfect oranges and streets of stars where the sad eyes of my youth wander the atomic age paradise? Tasting the blood of a stark and wounded puberty? Oh, what years ago, what rapture lost in white heat of skin walls that patina my heart's despair? What fear disturbs my quiet night's grazing, stampedes my soul? Oh, memory, I sweat the eternal weight of graves.
Now that is absolutely intense. That was the first one that I pulled out of the book. The fact that it was dedicated to Robert Duncan is an important part of it. But just the ending, why don't you elaborate on that ending, if you will?
Well, I think in that last sentence, it capsulizes what I believe my job is as a poet. Almost as though I were in the process of storytelling, resurrecting. By being the best craft person I can be, then I can honor those memories of those I treasure. Whether it's a friend, whether it's a community, or my vision of a community, what I see, how I define, as my place, which is Los Angeles, defines me, I in turn define it. And I want to be as true to this process as possible. So I'm obligated, I feel, to do my best. So when I say I sweat the eternal weight of graves, I am embracing the responsibility that attends that process. One of the things that I've decided that my writing has value, and I felt that I was a part of a community that wasn't being documented historically, that events and things were occurring on a level that no one seemed to recognize, or if they did want to recognize, certainly didn't want to publicize. So I was interested in making a record of that, so to speak, and I chose poetry and short fiction so far as my media in which to do that. I wanted to tell the stories. You know, that the popular word is griot in the African American community.
G-R-I-O-T.
That's correct. And I wanted to perform that function, to become a medium for those who couldn't speak, with whom I shared a common landscape and experience. And Los Angeles is so different as an urban landscape. It's much more different than the usual city that you find in the United States. There's no tradition. The terrain is extremely fluid, especially the cultural terrain. There's no way to nail it down. There's no way to corner the market effectively in Los Angeles. And so in the last 30 years, a very diverse and interesting group of literati have grown up there, and I'm among them. And so coming from the black side of town, from across the tracks, so to speak, from Watts, I have been interested in keeping those stories in the forefront of the dialogue. And I do that through my performance and poetry, through publishing my work, through insisting that there is another way of looking at these matters, these issues. At that point in time, I was married. I had just started my family. You know, I had two children. And living with my first husband, and our lives were very difficult economically. And socially, I was in a mixed marriage in a city that wasn't too kind to racial, to crossing racial lines. And so we had a pretty tough time. And when Watts exploded, that was the first time in the history of the nation that blacks really took the liberty to be publicly vocal about how we really felt about our history, our lack of history, and how we had been treated. And in Watts at that time, a number of workshops and cultural centers sprang up in that part of South Central Los Angeles. And so there was a lot going on. There was a lot of interest. There was a great deal of media attention. And I was at the heart of that. I was attending Studio Watts. Another alumna of Studio Watts is Jane Cortez out of New York, who you might recognize her name. So the poet, Jane Cortez, had a drama and acting workshop at the time. The artist Sonny Bustian came out of Studio Watts workshop. So we're kind of some of the survivors of the success stories of that particular community venue. But there were others. There was Mafundi Institute. There was the Watts Writers Workshop, which was notoriously associated with Bud Schulberg, who had come out of New York into Los Angeles to build something, erect something positive out of the ashes there. So there were all these things going on. At the time, there were coffee houses and a lot of cultural fulmination. And as the sole writer at Studio Watts, I found that I was encouraged to develop my gift. You know, that there actually, I had never heard of grantsmanship, for example. That's where I first discovered that that whole world exists. You know, I knew nothing about the literary world. And the first time I saw Miri Baraka's work, I was actually presented with his manuscript, a manuscript of a book that was about to be published. And I was given the manuscript to say, you know, to show what the potential was for me as a poet. And I was allowed to take the manuscript, you know, home and look at it and read it and study it and bring it back on my honor, which I did. I was able to get a scholarship. Writers, they had the famous writer school at that time. I received the first scholarship from the famous writer school and was able to take formal lessons to give me some of the craft underpinnings that I needed to really develop as a poet. So that began, and I was treated with respect. My gift wasn't dismissed. At that time, the school system in Los Angeles was very repressive and very dismissive of gifted young blacks. Here was an arena where we were being nourished. And this was some of the first nourishment I received. So that helped me start to look at those negatives and turn them into positives.
We have turned away from that. I'm guessing that this is some great society money that went into these programs. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. These were residuals of JFK administration cultural programs. The NEA hadn't or was about to come into existence around that time. The NEA and the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities. So these were monies that were feeding the culture, and I was one of the, I'm a byproduct of that kind of energy, really. But I think you summed it up well. There are those who appreciate from the outside, and who, so they have an aesthetic appreciation of the form, and then there are those who become it, or who allow it to inhabit them, and then it speaks through them. I mean, that's usually, that defines the difference between singers often when they're approaching material. There are those who exist on the surface of a given art and who don't really, are unable to really plumb the depths. And then there are those who are just simply as though they're vessels, like seeing Betty Carter sing, for example, as I was able to do while she was still living, and catch her. It was as though the voice inhabited her, and she was a temporary caretaker for this phenomena that came up through her and would zap the audience. I mean, it was incredible to see this woman perform live. You know, unfortunately, she's no longer with us, and so the world is deprived of her presence. But this woman was an incredible performer. And yet, the rooms would be filled and packed. When she'd play L.A., the rooms would be virtually empty. But they would be filled for someone who didn't have a tenth of her gift, which is one of the tragedies of that kind of magic. It's a magic that is yet to really be appreciated in our society. You need those who do appreciate the form, though, even if they can't be it.
Right.
Because they're important too, and they do serve a role. And you need your fans. You need your Amiri Baraka is a wonderful soul, and I saw him read on the stage at Columbia University, and he had Philly Joe Jones with him and Archie Shepp. And this man wanted to be, he wanted to wail so bad. He was off, and he was gone, is the expression, from the Beats.
A la Coltrane.
He was gone, absolutely. And he was so intense, so involved in the poem that he was reading, that he was moving closer to the stage and actually fell from the stage. And the audience, you know, the brother sitting in the front, which included my husband, saw him coming, you know, towards the edge of the stage. And as he fell, they all reached out their arms and caught him and lifted him back up onto the stage, which was a wonderful moment. But he, at that point, he was making his transcendence. He was moving off of the page, and he was blowing. This was his axe. And even if he was tone deaf, that was not going to stop him. So he created this marvelous moment, was created out of that intense desire to reach for transcendence and to transcend.
Which was the essence of Coltrane.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and jazz and poetry have that something in common. To me, they're so related, but not everybody gets that.
Well, to make the leap in a way that's not secular, or a way that's non...
linear?
Well, to make that leap between what's physical and on the page to the spiritual, whatever one perceives the spiritual realm to be, that seems to be something that man is constantly trying to do, whether we're talking about a rocket scientist or an astronomer, or whether we're talking about a financier, or whether we're, you know, there's the constant reach for the higher, that other dimension that gives our lives value. And so poets, of course, are not exempt often from wanting to reach that, although there are poets to whom this is of no value, that they're simply interested in here and now. But when that happens, and when that happens between you and the page, sometimes the mistake is to assume that you need some sort of substance to act as a bridge between you and it. And I think that's one of the values that jazz as a form has, although it too has been impacted by that kind of assumption, that here is a way to do it through excellence. You take care of your instrument, and it will take care of you. What to do about Billie Holiday? The answer, and this is for Robert L. Greenfield. Now, once Billie Holiday starts jonesing around in your blood, and you're turning the colors of her moods, there's nothing you can do about the itch in your ear. And you must forget about those gold sequins that keep blitzing the inner screen of your eyeballs. Two, that thumping that starts at the back of your head and makes its way along your spine, rumbles around in your hip bones, tremors nearly dislocating them. Learn, you can cope with the aesthetic of it. Provided your spirit's strong with song, you can't go wrong. So what if you've gotten your belly full of star fruit? So what if even your Mojava heat can't rid you of those croony riffs encasing your feet in rhythm? So what if a manhole was opened in the main line to your soul? So what if noon after buzzy noontime, you find Billy dancing in and out of your groin? And so what if she's bled you whiter than a camellia's ghost and blued your eyes into the sky above her pain? Don't fight her. Might as well fight spring. Don't rue the whiskey-stained dark that gave birth to her. Don't deny that doomed truth news of her final demise, or put a damper on your 78 groove, or silence those night-shine strummings on your heartstrings. So your throat's stung, deep smoked by those heady embers of cafe society torch? Swallow! Time to love it and live it again. Relax. Let Lady flow.
Hope you enjoyed that selection of the poems of Wanda Coleman. Wanda Coleman hailed from Los Angeles, born in 1946, passed away in 2013. Her books were published by Black Sparrow, amongst others, and one of her most well-known books is Wicked Enchantment, Selected Poems. Coming up, we'll play some of the work of Eileen Miles. Here she is.
Well, I mean, personally, I come from a long line of alcoholics, so it was hard. It wasn't hard to miss, but it's had a huge impact on my writing. Both, it was like when I was younger, you know, drugs and alcohol seemed like part of the mix, part of the mix of the culture of the poet. You know, when I got to town in New York, I felt I had a radical permission to drink as much as I wanted, and then you know, learn that poets took drugs too, and that all seemed possible and good. And, you know, for a while it actually helped me write. You know, speed was great. You know, I mean, alcohol, maybe a hangover could be good when the coffee hit and you would hit this, you know, you would have a few hours of sort of really exhilaration in the morning. I mean, all these phases passed quickly, but there were a few years where it seemed to be very, you know, it was very friendly with writing, you know, and then that started to end, and then a lot of things started to end, and I was very lucky to see the writing on the wall and realize that if I didn't stop, I would die, like, you know, members of my family have. But then it became a whole, I mean, I read someplace that there are water poets and there are wine poets, and I felt that it was time for me to become a water poet, and so you kind of start to shoot for a kind of clarity, and my poems became less busy, and they moved differently, and they became longer, and they became thinner, and I became more attached to a visceral necessity to go out. That's when I really much more consciously began to go out and get a poem, and even change as a poet, you know, because, for instance, I got sober in the 80s when poetry was not at its popular zenith in New York. Like, the poetry rock moment had ended. And if you told, you know, I always, this is like my joke about it, but if you told somebody to party in New York that you were a poet in the 80s, they would just look at you like you had said you were a mime. You know, it was not cool. And people, you know, the assumption being you were broke, you had a day job, and you were pathetic, you know. And so, but the performance scene was booming. You know, PS122 became the venue of you know, excitement in New York rather than the Poetry Project. And so I just hooked on to that and started memorizing my poems. And with the new expanded consciousness of the sober alcoholic, I could do that. I was much more aware of the visceral nature of poetry, of how much space was around me, of how political the situation was to look at an audience. Because once you put the page down, you stopped looking down, and you started looking up, and you looked at them, and you felt all the energy around you. So I really had 10 years of expansion that forever changed my work. I started memorizing stories. I started writing more stories. I started creating performance pieces that I toured then. So it was kind of suddenly, I mean, I grew up really fast and got pretty interested in the notion of selling myself as a poet, making a living as a poet, and thinking that you just really had to kind of reinvent yourself every now and then. And I continue to do that. And even running for president in the early 90s was part of that. No, not so much the selling of Eileen as the expanding of Eileen and hitting a wall with realizing that you know, no political aspects to being female, to being 40, to thinking, oh, am I less cute and I'm on the cultural junk heap now? Or am I a candidate for American power, you know? So at 40, I ran for president, and that opened a whole other thing up. At Mills. The moon is so not a star. The sky is blue, a drop. I will come in and do my reading. Yes. Okay. Now.
You went to New York City to be a poet.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I had a little, I think the last job I had in Boston was at a publishing company, and I had written poems since I was a kid, but I had, at this job, which was just, you know, a crummy office job, I had a typewriter in front of me all day long, and so, so I would write poems on my typewriter all day long at work. It was great. It was a great poet job. But one day I wrote a poem at work, and it was a good one, and I looked at the poem, and I had this, like, amazing, I mean, I had a spiritual experience. I looked at the poem, and I thought, oh, this is real, and the job is not, you know? And it was kind of like this sort of flip-flop where the context became really the background, and the real context became the poem. And then, I mean, I was going to New York to be in graduate school, and I lasted for about 10 seconds, but the point was, it got me, you know, graduate school got me to New York, and then, you know, the East Village at that moment in the 70s, it was like an explosion of, you know, Patti Smith was just starting to perform out, and there was a real poetry rock moment that was incredibly exciting, and it was like, who would want to bother being in graduate school, you know? And I just stayed and just went out and read.
Yeah, do you remember the poem that gave you that spiritual experience?
Yeah. I mean, it's not one I read, it's not one I've published either. But it's kind of, you know, it's there.
What's the title of it?
I think it's called Swan Song. Yeah, and I met Ellen when I was 25. I went to the New Yorican Poets Cafe, and at that time it was sort of like it was a little gay connection, because Burroughs and Ginsberg and whoever else, you know, liked the young Puerto Rican boys who hung out at the New Yorican Cafe. So they were right. We assumed they were all there to hear us, you know.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, it was the boys. But nonetheless, Alan heard me read a poem, and he just came running up to me and was like, who are you, and stuff, and connected. And in his weird Alan way, of course, he didn't know what to do with me. It was clear that this girl was sort of boyish, and that maybe, and I think he quickly figured out that I was queer. But that didn't stop him from trying to fix me up with his boyfriend. You know, because Alan was just a tribal sort, and it was sort of like, here's a girl, I don't know what to do with her, so I'll fix her up with Peter. You know, and he even walked up to me at a reading at St. Mark's Church a week or two later, and I was standing there with a circle of poets. We were all, you know, young people in their 20s, and me and the guys, basically, and Alan walked up and bowed very politely and said, Peter Olofsky would like to take you on a date. May he call you? It was like, it was so old world. He was inviting me on a date. It was like an arranged date with me and his boyfriend. And I actually would have gone, because I just didn't know what to do with a date with Peter, you know, with Allen Ginsberg's boyfriend, except to go on it. And then, you know, but in fact, it never happened. And, you know, but Alan was very quick to, you know, he liked me and was very open and was trying to do what he knew to do with me. Though he did, he hooked me up with Ferlinghetti too, and got me published in City Lights, which I thought was just the beginning of everything. And, you know, kind of was.
It kind of was. And
it kind of wasn't. It kind of wasn't.
Yeah. It's like, all right, now you're published. It's 5 years before anything happens after that. Right?
Yeah. Poetry career is not a career. I flew into New York and the season changed. A giant burr. Something hot was moving through the city that I knew so well. On the plane, though, it was white and stormy, faceless. I saw the sun and remembered the warning in the kitchen of all places, in which I was informed my wax would melt. No one had gone high around me. Where's the fear? I asked the sun. The birds are out there in their scattered sheep. The people in New York, like a tiny chain gang, are connected in their knowing and their saving one another. The morning trucks growl, oh, save me from knowing myself, if inside I only melt. Yeah, no, I think people just get hammered with information. I mean, we all do. And it's like, what do you do with it? And I think the good fortune of being a poet is we have something to do with it, you know? And if you don't, and you just keep getting hammered, and then you're pushed out into the marketplace to find a way to survive in that, it's sort of like this, suddenly the space of available possibility, imagination just shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and then government cutbacks on, you know, poets in the schools, all the ways that, I mean, like, we're an opportunity to expand, you know, and whether that opportunity is allowed to contact, you know, the young mind is, you know, American freedom. I wrote harmonica when I was it was in that sort of gap where it was sort of like one thing was deeply over and really, 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 really over, and something new was sort of about to happen, and it almost seemed like the only way to jump off into the pool of the new was to let the old become as completely dark and fizzled as it possibly could be. So I kind of, you know, there's a way in which you can't let yourself be as entirely sad as you are, unless you know that you're gonna be, you can get out of that room, you know. And so it was sort of like there's something so funny about this poem because it's such a sorrowful, bluesy poem. But it really was because I could see the light at the end of the tunnel and was gonna be moving towards it. Harmonica. Don't want to put my glasses on because I don't want to see. Don't want to move again because I don't want to live. Don't want to love again because I don't want to lose. Don't want to eat again because I don't want to be full. Don't want to drink again because I don't want to feel quenched. Don't want to sleep again because I don't want to wake up. Don't want to live in the summer because I don't want to be hot. Don't want you to kiss me again because I don't want to be alive. Don't want to see you again because I don't want to vanish. Don't want to ride my bike because I don't want to get there. Don't want to know my family anymore because I don't want to remember me. Don't want to walk my dog because I don't want to be out. Don't want to stay in anymore because I don't want to be alone. Don't want to be tired anymore because I don't want to feel old. Don't want to eat candy anymore because I don't want to feel sweet. Don't want to talk to my friends anymore because I don't want them to know me. Don't want to sing anymore because I don't want to hear me. Don't want to die anymore because I don't want to see God. Don't want to live anymore because I don't want to repeat.
Was that a healing thing for you?
Yeah. Because I was just, it was kind of like, oh my God, I didn't, you know, the shame about certain feelings.
And it's about being rejected.
About not even wanting to exist. It's sort of like this, it's often this seems like to be a vital person, you have to want to be alive. And what about if you don't want to be alive at all? You feel like all the doors are closed, and as you knock on each one, there's nobody on the other side. And what do you do with that state? And you recoil, you know? And it was interesting to just walk right up to each door and knock and find it empty and knock and find it empty and knock and find it empty. I think I always was interested in the idea that a poem was a job in a way, and that you had to kind of go out and do it and go out and get it, which incidentally, I mean, like, again, Ted was sort of a master at discussing and you know, the role of the poet, you know, what was that? And clear with making it clear that each poet reinvents what that means, you know? So I think pretty early on, I realized that there was some real connection between my metabolism and the poem. If I felt something and I didn't know what to do with that feeling, I could go out and find it. You know, and it's not so different from when I was a kid just coming home with piles of trash in my pockets. And, you know, I'd walk in the door, my mother would, like, make me empty out my pockets, and it'd be like half the world was in there. You know, I thought that was great. And I think I still do that, you know. And so skies, very literally, accidentally, you know, I live in New York, and I lived in New York then, but I had a lover who bought a house in Provincetown, and we spent 4 years spending half the time, you know, on the tip of Cape Cod, which was great because I come from Massachusetts and I was drunk on the accent that I grew up on, you know, and suddenly I was in, so it was a really lively language connection, but the landscape was sensational. So what I would do was just take the dogs for these long walks and look up and be just almost freaked out by the sky. You know, we were often there off season, like in the fall and the winter, where it was this incredibly shifting thing that was purple and brown. And I never knew skies did so many things. And as a New Yorker who was used to, like, the sky being this kind of funnel, like this crack between buildings that I had watched shift and change for 25 years then, it was just like great and scary and erotic and organic. And so I've been writing about art as a, you know, one of the many gigs to support myself and love to do, and I've learned about just looking and describing art, because I didn't come from an art history background, so I just used my poethood to, like, you know, look at paintings. And so I just turned that on. I turned that on the sky. And so it just made it my job to, like, you know, notate what I saw and connect my current feelings or whatever other observations to it. And then I discovered, because I travel constantly, that I could drag this gig everywhere. It was sort of like a Linus blanket or something, the sky. And so I was here in the Northwest, there's poems in this book from that. I'd be sitting outside of a reading at Mills College writing a poem about the sky, and they would make me come in and do my reading, and there's a little poem that does that. So it was just a great – and it was all – I was writing a novel called Cool for You, so it was kind of like the gig between the gig, you know. And so it was just like I had a way of knowing when I was writing a poem, I would just pop the sky in.
You wrote that long before September 11th.
And I didn't, and it was always like, I always found the ending, although I liked the ending and I knew it was right, the save me from knowing myself if inside I only melt. I just didn't know what to do with that line. I thought, that's so disturbing. What do I mean? It sounds so depressed. I mean, I just felt like, you know, certainly I write sad and lonely lines all the time, but it was just like that one. I just went to some dirty place where I thought, where the hell is it? And now every time I read the poem, people go, oh. It's so weird. Like the poem found its culture, you know?
Yeah, and that doesn't happen with the other school of poetry, does it?
Well, the thing is, I feel like if you're so busy constructing the present correctly, you never have time to get to the future, you know? Whereas if you're dropping things wildly because you're in a rush to be here, then you often run ahead of yourself, you know? And you're dropping little seeds, you know, that you won't be able to pick up for a year or two.
Yeah, and you say the poetry, the poem beats you down the street. What was your line? That's it, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's ahead. The poem is ahead of you, I think.
The poem is ahead of you. Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think this is sort of like poets can easily align themselves with the desire for the poet to be dead. You know, because the dead poet is much more easily historicized and kind of, you know, kept. It's not a revolution, kids. It's something we study as a dead science, you know, and then we can see where the beats are and count the metrics and really not be disturbed by this stuff, but just sort of dissect it quietly and you know.
And control it?
Uh-huh. Good. Yeah, yeah. And so it's sort of like, but Olson being the person who, you know, used the word proprioception, you know, in poetry. It's sort of like writing poetry with a sense that you're actually in a body enacting this poem in a real moment, you know, that alive moment can never be gotten rid of even when the poet is dead. You know, it's very hard when I think about Ted's poems, for instance, or Alan's, to talk about this guy is not dead, you know, in that work, no. You know, and it's sort of like that's the problem and the glory of poetry, you know, and it's sort of like when you see poets start to take sides with the people who would prefer the poet to be dead, it might be helping them with their, quote, career right now, but it's not helping anybody else with anything else anywhere at all.
And in 200 years, people aren't going to read that work.
Well, when we see who people were reading at Whitman's, I mean, it was like some crazy sentimental, treacly poetry was being written in Whitman's moment. The best-selling poetry in America was... I don't know that it was it work by a woman? I hate to make that easy. It was like Miss Fanny's, you know, flower box or something. It was some insane sounding, you know, like ornate chocolate box of poetry, you know, and that was like the hit. You know, Whitman was this weird guy who was like, you know, writing fake reviews of himself by Emerson. I mean, it's also like this, I think even in our world, our poetry world, I think there's kind of a, people look down a little bit on self-promotion in a way, except like, please look through history at poets that we know and love, including Alan, and what genius they were at self-promotion. I feel like it's part of, you know, it's like part of a poet's duty is to make him or herself known, you know, and to figure out a new way to do that, you know. Well, sure. I mean, it's sort of like we are everywhere, so to act like we're not. And actually, that was one of the things I was impressed by the marathon last night, because in a small room, you know, there were some local queers, you know, these kids, you know, it was a girl who got up and I was like, whoa, she's a dyke, you know, and I didn't expect it. But why was that? That was my own sort of, you know, big city prejudice that, you know, even though I know we are everywhere, I always think we're running from everywhere towards, you know, New York, San Francisco and stuff. So I was impressed by the diversity of Auburn.
And, you know, to have you come in into the high school class where in a traditional town, these kind of subjects aren't really talked about. They're really closeted is a beautiful thing because, you know, there's a couple of kids in the class who, if not out and out queer, they're considering or experimenting or thinking about it or questioning, certainly.
Just gender issues, period. You know, there's a right way for a girl to be, a right way for a boy to be. It's sort of like that's all pretty slidey inside of kids' heads, and it's true. I think it's great for adults to walk in and say, not only is it slidey, you can go someplace different, you know. He was great. I mean, his house and Alice's house. I mean, I said studied just because it was a bio, and that was the way to put it. I mean, Ted did these workshops at St. Mark's where he would just kind of orate. You know, he would just sit down at a table and just talk about poetry, and there'd be like 50 of us sitting there, you know? I mean, it's amazing. And Alice had a smaller workshop where we went on Friday nights, and we would just bring beers, and it was like a hot – we all, like the younger scene of poets at that time, we all met at Alice's workshop. But the real scene was at their house, because once you met them, then you would go over to their house at 101 St. Mark's Place and just kind of hang out, you know? And so I'll never forget the night that I went to visit them. I remember, like, I had, you know, some pills and some beers and, you know, in my bag and stuff and some poems, and I just walked around the block and around the block and around the block. I was scared. It was like the date of a lifetime, you know, and finally went up and sat there and just didn't even know to leave and just sat there for like 6 hours. And Ted lay on his bed and Alice sat in the front room, and you'd have a conversation with Alice and Ted would keep yelling things out from the bed, you know, and stuff. And then every now and then come into the bed and sit on the edge of the bed with Ted, and Ted would be like smoking a cigarette in the usually often with his shirt off and the ash like hitting his belly slowly, repetitively over time. And then I'd hand my poem to Ted and he would read it. And then we'd be like, hey, Alice, read this. And go into the other room and, you know, and all the time, you know, the kids, Anselm and Edmund, who are, you know, guys now, were like in their like little bunk beds, you know, one room away, you know, with their dinosaur books. And it was such a scene. And every poet who... It was a very mishmash. It was a very mixed poetry world. Like Barry Watton would come to town. He would be there. Steve Abbott, you know, whoever. You know, it's just like their place had that salon atmosphere that was sort of – and half the time it's like they were broke. You'd bring – some, you know, we would all give what we, you know, there was like a temple atmosphere. You'd bring what you had, you know, and stuff. And often we were all broke, and we all had like books to sell and figuring out which books to sell. And it was just, there was a lot of exchange and talk and commerce and just sweetness. I mean, you knew as you stood there, it's like, just be here and, you know, just be here, because this is like really, this is your growing up, you know.
That's where it's happening. That's where the juice was.
Uh-huh. You know? Ted was funny. He was just, like, very direct. He could be very painful. He was very good at knowing what somebody's vulnerabilities were and just pushing you right there if he felt like doing it, you know. And then he was very gentle and very sweet with us, with his kids. Quick critic, you know, and was just really clear when he thought something was great and generous, you know.
And his work. How would you describe? How are people going to remember his work?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of it. But the easiest thing to say, though, is that the sonnets, everybody knows, is a masterpiece. You know, I mean, I just feel like, I mean, if you write one book in your life that, like, is sort of, like, unforgettable and undyingly influential, I mean, I think it's the sonnets. I mean, all the other ones, too, it's sort of like work that he wrote before I met him and while he was, you know, while he was alive was great, too. And it you know, and Ted Talking, of course, was a great work. I mean, there's some book of interviews and conversations and talks that Ted gave, which were pretty amazing. But yeah, I think he was like a fan of poetry who turned into a master, like right out of his own fanship, you know, because it seems like the sonnets are such, you know, they're such like hot plastic work. You know, he was just like, you know, staying up all night and just like putting all of poetry together in a new way. And I love that he was influenced by his buddy Joe Brainard and, you know, saw Joe's collages and said, I can do this in language. And I think there was a lot of contemporary... Maybe scorn is a hard word to use, but suspicion, because it was like, is he doing something new? I mean, he really took appropriation to the nth degree, you know, and I think that Ted knew that he could do it. And he was a triumph of class, because he was a really, you know, lower class to working class guy who grew up in a family with refrigerators on the lawn and stuff, and, you know, really kind of made himself, you know, was in the army and was a little older than the other poets that he came up with, and just was a little kind of big guy, a little bit out of it, and just yet full of kind of a wide charm, you know, that just resonated and still does.
You say on page 63 of On My Way in the End of New England, that essay, always we are guided towards the accent of the middle class, never to the blurred cadences of the workers,
uh-huh.
Unless you want to be an actor.
Right. Yeah, and it's sort of like that whole kind of James Dean thing where all these bourgeois kids come to New York and suddenly they're like slouching in T-shirts and stuff and say, give me it, you know, and acting, you know, like, babe. You know, just kind of put on kind of like a little thug thing, but it's sort of like, it's sort of the Johnny Depp school of, you know, bourgeois. Well, actually, I don't know about Johnny Depp might be a working class guy, but it's sort of like, it's a thing to be lower class. It's like sexy. It's Brando. I mean, that's for guy. I mean, actually, there isn't really. Well, no, I think a girl can be trashy, be waitress-like. It's, you know, be a trashy girl. It's all very, you know, like hot. But it's like nobody wants to get caught in those classes.
Yeah, don't write poetry like that.
No, or look at somebody like Philip Levine, an example of the working class poet and the bourgeois academic. It's all content. It's the sentimentality of the worker, or poems about when he worked in a factory. He doesn't change his English. It's like, and it was like, then this is not a working class poem if it's not written in a jargon that drops because the body is there. We know the body is there. That's what the whole basis of working class speech is. The body is there. We can see the body. So we don't need to say everything. We don't need to speak in full sentences.
So, for example, something like duck, you know,
uh-huh.
you use that American vernacular to get someone's attention, and then you speak in quote-unquote normal sentences.
Exactly. And so it's that incredibly sexy shifting of attention all the time that we do. I mean, like in the essay I mentioned, it's sort of like if you're in bed with somebody, you could say water, meaning, you know, pick up the, we've just been fucking for an hour, pick up the bottle of water off the floor and give it to me. And in a soft, tender, direct cadence that is not considered inexplicable or inarticulate. You know, it's sort of like what's illegible in one context is completely direct and even loving in another. And to be able to keep pulling the context around and closing the distance creates an intimacy. John Ashbery says this. I mean, he says the same thing that you know, it's like within these schools, there are many schools, and yet everybody's in a way saying the same thing, that it's sort of like you write the poem as if the person, as if the reader were in the same room with you. And so you don't need to talk about the blue. You don't always say that the wall is blue. We know it's blue. We're sitting in a blue room, you know? And so you talk about something else, you know?
So we go to one of the main distinctions between the open form poets, if we can call them that,
uh-huh.
and the academic poets. And that is that academic poetry, there's something inauthentic about it.
Well, they're still trying to get in the room. We are in the room. You know, and I try to talk like I'm in a society that knows it's in the room. And so that it's sort of like you start by being here now, you know, and you write from that place, you know, because where am I? I'm in the studio with you, Paul. There's no way that you and I would act like, you know, like we had. I mean, if we bothered to explain every little bit of technology that was making this conversation possible, we wouldn't even begin to have the conversation, you know.
Right. The center of any linguistic use is use, and
uh-huh.
closing the distance
uh-huh.
is what you say. Yeah.
Hi, you've been listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. This is Droma Text. We're here once a week on a Thursday between 8 and 9 p.m. with a selection of spoken word recordings. You've been listening to the work of Eileen Miles, New York poet, born in 1949, once a director of the Artistic Director of the St. Lawrence Poetry Project down in New York. Check out her work over the World Wide Web. We'll finish off tonight's show with a couple poems by Deanne De Prima. Here she is.
And for Loba, I'd like to finish with the last of the street poems, street women poems, and then one poem that kind of might be a reflection on it. First is called Ishtar. Deliberate as the shell of a body you offer, ungainly on the steps. Scratch of your voice in the shadows, 3 a.m. Gold shorts and hot pink tights. High heels and that ravaged face. What are you selling anyway? Deliberate, your limbs dislocated, awkward from drugs. You caricature the human stream. Enfold the secret essence, perfect, bittersweet, though it does to death. Oh, sister, softer than watered silk, gray, white, black shadows of your ebony skin, your heart, edible as chocolate. You enclose the prize, and you know it. Gate of death, encumbrance, golden morning of the world, you offer it like poisoned silk to the grinding, belching traffic, hordes of dirty men, like poisoned, watered silk to wrap them round. No problem, party poem. First glass broken on patio, no problem. Forgotten sour cream for vegetables, no problem. Lewis McAdams, tough lower jaw, no problem. Cops arriving to watch belly dancer, no problem. Plastic bags of melted ice, no problem. Wine on antique tablecloth, no problem. Scratchy stereo, no problem. Neighbor's dog, no problem. Interviewer from Berkeley Barb, no problem. Absence of more beer, no problem. Too little dope, no problem. Leering neuropins, no problem. Cigarette butts on the altars, no problem. Marilyn vomiting in planter box, no problem. Phoebe renouncing love, no problem. Lewis renouncing Phoebe, no problem. Hungry ghosts, no problem. Absence of children, no problem. Heat, no problem. Dark, no problem. Arnica scattered in nylon rug, no problem. Ashes in bowl of bleached bones and juniper berries, no problem. Lost sati tape, no problem. Loss of temper, no problem. Arrogance, no problem. Boxes of empty beer cans and wine bottles, no problem. Thousands of styrofoam cups, no problem. Gregory Corso, no problem. Allen Ginsberg, no problem. Diane DePrima, no problem. Ann Waldman's veins, no problem. Dick Gallup's birthday, no problem. Joanne Kiger's peyote and rum, no problem. Wine, no problem. Coca-Cola, no problem. Getting it on in the wet grass, no problem. Running out of toilet paper, no problem. Decimation of pennyroyal, no problem. Destruction of shell hair clasp, no problem. Paranoia, no problem. Claustrophobia, no problem. Growing up on Brooklyn streets, no problem. Growing up in Tibet, no problem. Growing up in Chicano, Texas, no problem. Belly dancing, certainly no problem. Figuring it all out, no problem. Giving it all up, no problem. Giving it all away, no problem. Devouring everything in sight, no problem. What else in Alan's refrigerator? What else in Anne's cupboard? What do you know that you haven't told me yet? No problem, no problem, no problem. Staying another day, no problem. Getting out of town, no problem. Telling the truth, almost no problem. Easy to stay awake. Easy to go to sleep. Easy to sing the blues. Easy to chant sutras. What's all the fuss about? It decomposes, no problem. We pack it in boxes, no problem. We swallow it with water, lock it in the trunk, make a quick getaway, no problem.
So you were listening to Diane DePrima. That finishes up tonight's edition of Droma Text. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of The Spoken Word. Till then.
Tonight, sweetie, I'm making you your favorite meal. It's the least I can do after an entire week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your friends, and shouting at you. Yeah, tonight, I'm making you your favorite meal so I can start another week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your...
Violence against women stops here. Contact SOS Violence Conjugale. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT. We're on the air. Let the I-5 fly for CKUT. CKUT.
De région ou d'une région à proximité est rouge. Afin de limiter la propagation de la COVID-19, les rassemblements d'amis ou de famille sont interdits et les déplacements vers d'autres régions doivent être évités. De plus, en zone rouge, il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 20h et 5h le matin. Visitez québec.ca/coronavirus pour connaître les règles spécifiques mises en place pour établir la situation. Respectez toutes les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Oh, merci beaucoup, Mme Saint-Onge. J'aurais fait l'intro de Francis et les exerciceurs. C'est CKUT, Radio McGill. Ce soir, une émission spéciale live en onde. Ça s'intitule... Oh là là, OK. OK. Ça s'intitule Radio Heart One Week Later, en radiophonique, une semaine plus tard. Le titre de la pièce, c'est « Je n'ai pas de courriel. Appelez-moi 418-328-4510 ». The title piece is I don't have any email. Call me 418-328-4510. On est trois personnes ce soir à faire de l'art radiophonique. Jonas Slovensky, qui avant s'appelait Benoît Fauteux, mais depuis le label Monsieur Fauteux, m'entendez-vous
non,
avec la fanfare pour.
Non,
en tout cas, il a changé de nom, il devenait trop vedette. Là, je sais pas.
Mon micro est ouvert,
moi. Oui, mais oui. Tu t'entends pas? Bon, Francis.
T'entends plus que moi, hein?
Lève ton. Ben, t'es trop loin ici. Francis Cropo-Mélomanie.